Tonight on America's Hope, we focus on the housing situation in America, and we also focus on the law enforcement community and its relationship to other communities around the United States. America's Hope starts now. From the NTD Global Headquarters, I'm Kelly Wright, and this is America's Hope. We thank you for joining us this hour. And wherever you are, we do hope that you're safe and well, taking care of yourself and your family because you matter. A lot matters to you if you're a homeowner. How high is the mortgage? How high is your interest rate? And are enough homes being built? And then if you're paying rent, oh my goodness, some of you are scratching your head saying, this is just too high. Affordability is what we're talking about tonight with the housing crisis in America. We'll be talking to Dean Baker about that. And then later on in our program, we'll talk about the importance of having a growing, actively caring relationship between police and the communities. Kenyatta McKinnon will stop by to talk about that, as well as focusing on her nonprofit campaign, which is to empower people and transform lives. Let's get started. And welcome to America's Hope. I'm joined now by Dean Baker, and he has just penned a new book. He's the author of Housing the Nation, Social Equity Architecture, and the Future of Affordable Housing. You know, Dean, this is very important. I should make note of the fact that housing in America is something that many people aspire to do. It's part of the American dream, making sure that families can have a home to call their own. Yet in your book, you're talking about the fact that it is daunting. It's a challenge. What's going on with our housing issue?
Yeah, well, first off, let me just be clear. I'm only one of the authors of the book, so I'm not the it's not my book. I contributed to it. I'm proud of that, but it's not my book. But yes, we have had a problem, a serious undersupply of housing. Now, obviously, our housing problems go back decades, so it's not as though we just got a housing problem. But the basic story, at least as I would put it, is that we were building housing very rapidly during the bubble years, which I would put roughly as 2000 to 2007. And then construction just collapsed. So to give you an idea, we were building over 2 million units a year at the peak of the bubble, 2004, 2005, into 2006. Then it just collapsed. And of course, we had the Great Recession, the financial crisis, and housing for a while fell under 1 million a year. So think of that. We were building over 2 million units a year. That might have been more than we needed, but whatever, roughly somewhere what we needed, near what we needed. And then we're below 1 million. Now, for 1 year, that's not that big a deal. But it stayed low, and it just very gradually inched up so that by the time of the pandemic, we're up around 1.3 million, which was still almost certainly well below what we needed. So again, for 1 year, if you're short 500,000 or whatever, you know, we have 160 million housing units, not a big deal. But if you do that for 12 years, 13 years, that's a really big deal. So we have a severe housing shortage in the country. The pandemic was interesting that we had countervailing things. On the one hand, the pandemic created all sorts of supply chain problems. The other hand, we had low interest rates. People got a lot of money with the government programs, both under, we could be bipartisan here. You had the CARES Act under Trump and then the Recovery Act under President Biden. And we did see a big increase in starts. It was up to 1.8 million. Then we got higher interest rates and they fell again. So we're about 1.4 million. I'd have to check the latest numbers. But we need more housing. That's long and short. And, you know, the question is, how can you best make up this gap in housing, make it easier for people to buy homes? And of course, we still have a third of the population of renters. Even if we got more people buying homes, you know, which I think is a good thing, we're still going to have an awful lot of renters. So we have to have rental housing that's affordable to people. And that's not the case right now.
You got that right. I mean, people in even rural areas are complaining about the rent. And, you know, notably here in the New York area, people have always said, as one political candidate said, the rent is just too damn high. So when you look at it like that, how do you make the rent affordable, given the fact that prices for the home, the housing market keeps keeps going up, 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 and beyond the reach of just people trying to eke out a normal day of life without having to to worry about the rent that they have to pay?
Yeah, well, obviously it's a supply and demand story. And the run-up in house prices really was very much an issue of constrained supply. I'll go into this in a second. But again, you go over a long period where we underproduce housing, you know, over a decade where we're producing, you know, probably less than, you know, 600,000 a year, fewer houses than we should have been. And that adds up over a decade, more than a decade. So we need to address the supply side. Now, there was an unusual story with the pandemic that is something really none of us, certainly I didn't predict, I don't know, we had this huge surge in work from home. So you had a lot of people disproportionately hiring people. I mean, you can't be a manufacturing worker working from home, retail worker working from home, but you have a lot of people who were able to work from home, and the increase in number of people working from home was almost 20 billion. That's huge. You know, about an eighth of the labor force was able to work from home. And additionally, just to be clear, so there were already people working from home in, you know, 2018, 2019 before the pandemic, that increased by 20 million. That created a huge increase in demand for housing because people were working from home. One hand, they needed a home office. They needed more space. I'll just say that, whether they had a home office or not, another question. But they needed more space because they're doing their work from home. The other thing is they had more money to pay for it because they weren't commuting. So people used to spend money driving their car into work, and you know they had to get business clothes for work. They saved a lot of money. They could afford to get a bigger home, whatever. And that happened in a really big way. And that was this huge run up in house prices, both rent and house sale prices in 2021, 22 was this huge surge in working from home. That's over now. I mean, people are still working from home, but the surge, the increase is behind us. So we are seeing house prices and rents, more importantly, perhaps rents leveling off. And there's some evidence rents are actually falling in many areas. So that's a good story. I mean, it's not going to bring us back to where we were in 2020 before the pandemic, but they have leveled off and they are coming down, and that's a good story. But again, we have to do a lot more, but that's at least immediately in the near term, there is some positive parts to this picture.
The positive parts of the picture are notable. The negative aspects of this is that Houston, we have a problem. And is this a Democrat problem, a Republican problem, or is it an American problem?
Well, we could be bipartisan. Both parties have not done everything they could have to foster it. I think the question, obviously, is what do you do going forward? And, you know, my answer, I think the obvious answer is you need to build more housing. And, you know, and there I will give the Biden-Harris administration, because they put proposals on the table to build more housing. They want to have subsidies for starter homes. Again, the exact form that takes, big question. And, you know, as everyone always says, the devil's in the details. So we'll see what that looks like. But the other thing that I think is in many ways more important is trying to remove the barriers to construction. And this is something, it's getting increasing awareness, you know, really across the board. It tends to be a bigger problem in blue states, if we want to be partisan here. It tends to be a bigger problem in Democratic states. But the Democrats have recognized that. So like in California, you have Governor Newsom, who's been very aggressive in trying to crack down on barriers to new construction. It's a big effort because the problem is every time you go, okay, let's get rid of this barrier, the barriers are there for a reason. I mean, there are people who want them. They're going, not in our neighborhood. You know, that's a classic story, NIMBY, not in my backyard. And, you know, that's a problem. But I think there are growing efforts to overcome that. And that's something that both President Biden and Vice President Harris has talked about, that they want to try to overcome those barriers, give local governments an incentive, put money on the table, go, here's money. If you can overcome those barriers, if you can build more units, here's money. And also, you know, highlight the places that are successful. So some places have had a lot of new construction. Minneapolis has had a lot of new construction in the last 5 years because, again, it's been deliberate policy. They've tried to promote new construction. So I think the question is, how do you go forward? And again, I'm not to be hugely partisan. I mean, I can identify the policies that President Biden, Vice President Harris have put on the table. I don't know. Maybe Donald Trump has said things along these lines. I've not seen it. I'll just say that.
Well, in fact, to your point, Kamala Harris, or Vice President Kamala Harris, has stated that, you know, she wants to see every American be able to afford a home. Now, that isn't a new thing, because you'll recall President George W. Bush basically said the same thing and embarked upon a plan to do that. And some have even criticized him for doing that because they believe that it may have contributed to the crash that we had
with
the housing market. Is Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, if she were to be elected, it is a razor-thin race so far. If she wins and she embarks upon that plan to make sure that every American has a home, that kind of investment from the government, does it portend of the same thing that we saw with the crash in our housing market before?
Yeah, well, you have to be careful. As I had, you know, my comment earlier, it devil's in the details. And, you know, there were a lot of things. And again, I was saying, it's true. You go back, I wrote this stuff back in 2002, 3, 4, 5, that we had really serious problems that they were visible before the crash. And I, you know, to my mind, it was just ungodly criminal that you didn't have, you know, the experts, the economists, the policy people raising the flags, because we had things where people were buying homes, putting down zero. In fact, in many cases, putting down less than zero. You had people borrowing more than 100% of the appraised value of their house. They would use the additional money to cover closing costs, moving costs, whatever it was. So that meant they got into a home, they literally had no cushion. And you had record high house prices. They were rising very rapidly. When they fell, you suddenly had all these people that owed 10, 20, 30% more of the value of their house. This was like 100% predictable disaster. Mm-hmm. So I hope, you know, that Vice President Harris, if she gets into office, that she's learned from that, you know, that's you need good lending standards. And they have put in better lending standards, in fairness. And again, it's largely been bipartisan, not completely, but largely bipartisan. So that was an obvious mistake that we saw during those years under President Bush that, again, I'm hoping we won't repeat it. It tends to be the case that when you make big mistakes, they aren't the same mistake. You know, so oftentimes we go great efforts to avoid the same mistake, and then we make another one. So, again, I can't guarantee that she'll come out with a plan, everything will work smoothly, but I don't think we'll make the same mistake.
Yeah, I don't want to stay on the politics, but it's worth discussing because our government has a lot to do with the housing market, as you know. And corporate America, the contractors, the construction people, they have certainly a big role to play. But on the Trump side of the camp, when he was in office, did we see, of course, we were hit by the pandemic at that time, but did we see any increase or uptick in people going out to buy houses? Keeping in mind, the interest rates were much lower. And I go on to say that I spoke with Larry Kudlow, who at the time was working in the Trump administration, and he predicted that we would be hit with inflation if we were working within a Biden administration. Well, we did see the inflation. I guess I'm just asking you, again, either side, they have to be concerned about housing in America and rent prices in America. And here you have one presidential candidate talking about, you know, controlling the prices as well as infusing, I guess she would be infusing cash or some sort of stimulus to make sure that people can go out and buy the house. And then we saw through that pandemic, people just not able to pay their rent at all. And now they're having to pay that rent for what happened during the pandemic. Where do the politicians lie on this, and how much influence does a president actually have on people paying their rent as well as getting a house?
Yeah, well, so the story on inflation in the pandemic was overwhelmingly the story of the pandemic. So the inflation that we had in the United States was very comparable to what you saw in France, Germany, pick your country. In fact, we're right about at the middle. Where we did do much better is that we had far more economic growth, far more wage growth. So we were one of the few places where wages outpaced inflation. So your average worker, the typical worker, actually saw larger increases than overall inflation rate. Now, rent rose somewhat more rapidly than the overall inflation rate. So rent is up around 25% since before the pandemic, which is a hair more than wages. Wages on average have increased about 23%. I could give you other measures where wages have gone up about 25, 26%. So it's very close, but rent did somewhat outpace inflation. But again, this was very much a pandemic story. And I mentioned the work from home issue. You had this huge surge, 20 million people, 19, but you know, almost 20 million people are now working from home than was the case before the pandemic. It created a huge rush in demand, wow. But we've gotten through that. So, you know, so we're through kind of the bad times. And again, we're getting better numbers on rental inflation month by month. And there's some series, as I say, that show rental inflation actually falling. So I'm not going to make a big point saying we're going to see a big fall in rents, but the direction of change is definitely a positive one for now. So I think we're seeing improvement there. But again, that doesn't address the underlying problem. I mean, if rents fell 1%, 2%, let's say we snapped our fingers at 1% or 2%, we still have a lot of people that are having trouble paying the rent. So what we need is, on the one hand, good wage growth, which we have been seeing. So if that maintains, you know, people's situations improve over time. But we do need more housing. That's the bottom line. If we get more housing, we will see lower rents. And that's, you know, that to my view is the key part of the story.
So it sounds like there's a lot of scenarios that would bring about some solutions to these problems with regard to rent. I'm talking to Dean Baker. He's the founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We're going to come back with much more. Welcome back to America's Hope. I'm talking to Dean Baker. He's the founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And look, America, everybody that we talk to likes their home. A house is a man's castle. It's a family's home. It's a place where you go to actually find some peace and solace. And yet, it's very difficult to pay the rent in various cities and even in rural areas, as Dean and I have just been discussing in the previous segment. So Dean, you identify the problems. What do you see as being the solution so that people can afford their rent and that they can afford to buy a home?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest thing is to build more housing. And as I said, a part of that story is overcoming the barriers that many cities have put up in the form of zoning. So I think that is the biggest thing. Well, if we get interest rates back down, and they're going down, but just to be clear, they're not going to go back to the pandemic level. So in the pandemic, you could get a 30-year mortgage, 3%, sometimes even a hair less at the low points. We aren't going to see that. But if we go back before the pandemic, mortgage rates were a little over 4, 4.5. We might get somewhere near that. Again, not immediately, but maybe sometime next year. That will be very, very helpful, both obviously people buying homes, but also for builders, because builders they have to borrow money typically to pay for a development. So I think, you know, hitting it both from the zoning side, lower interest rates, and then also, again, the Vice President Harris has proposed that you'd have subsidies for starter homes. And again, we have to see how that's defined, but encourage builders to build smaller homes that are going to be more affordable, because as it stands now, obviously they're in business to make money. So if they could build a big 3-bedroom house with a big yard and whatever else, you know, that typically is going to be more profitable than building, say, a 2-bedroom home that might be a good starter home for a young family, maybe with a kid, just, you know, plan to live there for a period of time and then maybe move up to a bigger home or whatever. But that would be, to my mind, that's the direction you have to go. You have to look to build more housing and basically figure out what's keeping us from doing it now, what will make it easier for builders to build more housing going forward.
It seems that what's keeping us from doing it now is the gridlock or the partisan divide that we see in Congress, where Congress, Republicans and Democrats, they're fighting about various legislative measures, and then they fight against the executive branch, the Biden administration. And depending on who wins this election, whether it's Vice President Kamala Harris or the former President Donald Trump, they'll be fighting yet again. So what does it take to get
the message? I don't anticipate a breakout of, I've been around Washington long enough. I don't think we're all going to be holding hands and agreeing on everything. But we have made progress in different areas. And a couple points here. One is, I think the biggest obstacles are actually at the local level. So obviously one city isn't going to fix the housing problem, but they could fix the housing problem in that city. And if we could get other cities to model the ones that are doing it right, I mentioned Minneapolis, you have some cities in Texas. Houston's built a lot of housing, much lower cost housing in Houston than in, say, San Francisco.
So how did they get it right and San Francisco didn't?
Well, it's restrictive. Well, two things I'll say. One is restrictive zoning. If you make it difficult to build, people won't build. The other part, and I have to say, as someone who's been in both Houston and San Francisco, Houston's a fine city, but you know, if I want to spend a weekend somewhere, it's more likely to be San Francisco, and that's because they've preserved a lot of their old neighborhoods. So it's a mixed story. I mean, if you want to have old neighborhoods that people think are really neat, they want to walk through, take their kids through, then you can't tear them down and build up high rises. But you can still have more building in San Francisco than you do. So I think that's kind of the answer that I, you know, I wouldn't, the people probably would say, okay, tear everything down and put up high rises everywhere. I wouldn't, but you could certainly build more housing in San Francisco. You might still have San Francisco costing more than Houston because, you know, it has features about it that Houston doesn't. People are willing to pay a premium for that. And, you know, I don't know what to do about that. People like living in places like that. I'd love to. I can't afford it, you know. Yeah. But the point is we can make it more affordable than it is now.
So Dean, what about opportunity zones? We saw that in the previous administration. I remember talking to then HUD Secretary Ben Carson, and he actually walked through a site wherein affordable housing had been established. The people who were getting into those affordable housing units were actually people who were on the lower middle class income area. And some of them were even coming off the homeless rolls into owning homes or even renting homes at a, and this was in the Washington, D.C. area, very, very high rate rent district. Do opportunity zones work? Is that something that both administrations can consider doing, depending on who becomes next president?
My view of opportunity zones is fairly negative, and since you do have some positive cases, but the question is how much money did you pay for that? So most of the analysis I've seen is that you're essentially moving things that largely would have been done elsewhere, but they go from outside the opportunity zone to the area you designate as the opportunity zone. Uh-huh. And you've given tax breaks that are often, you know, many times the value of the housing that was constructed. So I don't think that's a great route. Let me mention something else that really should be talked about in this context is that a lot of, you know, obviously we're having a big debate on immigration and, you know, obviously the parties are very different on that. But a lot of the people that come here as immigrants that are undocumented, they're in the construction industry. Somewhere around 20-25% of those people work in construction. So, I mean, you could do the calculations yourself. If you talk about large-scale deportations of undocumented workers, you're getting rid of a lot of your construction workforce, and they're going to be hard to replace. We could talk about creating jobs for the native born, but it's not as though we have 2 million people who tomorrow we can get out there and have working construction. So again, that's something I think people have to think about, whether that's going the right way or wrong way.
That's a very good point. And of course, it's one that people will debate on both sides, as you know. But like I like the fact that you talked about the local market and local politics being involved. Some of the key findings from your recent studies underscore the urgency of now with this housing and making sure that we can have a future of affordable housing. You say that in this article that you contributed to, or the book you contributed to, more than half of American renters who want to buy a home fear they'll never afford one. That does not go well for the American psyche. That means a lot of Americans are walking around struggling. You know, I've been there. You know, you walk around saying, can I ever get a home for my family, for my wife and children? It is a struggle and it weighs you down. Let's get beyond the facts that we've talked about. They're important facts. But let's talk about what's happening to the American psyche if Americans are walking around saying, I can't afford this and I can't afford that. That does not go well for a nation of American dreamers.
Yeah, we want people to be optimistic about the future. And one of the things that, you know, historically people have looked to do is become homeowners. And again, to solve that, it's not going to be an overnight, there's not an overnight answer. Again, building more housing, you know, I can talk about these things. You know, let's say they do it right by my view and, you know, we get more housing and the prices come down. None of that's an overnight story. But you know, you can talk about moving in the right direction. Also, wage growth. I mean, that's a big thing that if people are seeing higher wages, and actually they are. I mean, one of the good stories that's been underreported, as we've had this recovery, there's actually been very rapid wage growth at the bottom. So the bottom quintile has seen wage growth of about 10% in excess of inflation. That's extraordinary. At least it's extraordinary given what we've seen in the last half century. So that's a pretty good story. But again, you know, if you're making 20 an hour and now you're making 22 an hour, it's not as though you're doing great, you're doing better. But really it's mostly a long-term story. We can't talk about turning things around overnight, at least not realistically. Yeah. So what we have to do is see better wage growth, particularly for those at the middle and bottom. It can't be it can't be exclusively at the top, I should say, and more housing to make housing more affordable. But none of these things are gonna happen overnight.
So look, one thing that we didn't talk about, and you alluded to it earlier, and that was getting more jobs, more people out there to start building homes. That goes into the core issue of workforce development. And workforce development, making sure that people are employed or gainfully employed. Is that part of the solution as well?
Absolutely. And one of the things that, you know, we've seen this in many, many areas, maybe just about everywhere, you have shortages of people in skilled trades like plumbing, carpentry, electricians. And that's the sort of thing. I mean, we have a good set of community colleges in the country that I think have to be built up. The Biden administration, I think, has tried to do that. I believe Vice President Harris, if she gets in, will do that. I think that's a very, very important thing. But also you have apprenticeship programs with many of the unions, that the plumbers, the carpenters, they all have their own apprenticeship programs. We need to get more people into those. And that's it's an important thing. I mean, we talk about people being able to go to college and being able to afford it, and that's obviously important. But these are good jobs. Someone who gets skills as a plumber, as an electrician, that's a good paying job that someone can support themselves, have a good middle class living. And generally pretty secure employment, because, I mean, that could change. But at least for now, you don't see electricians, you don't see plumbers in most places looking for work. They have as much work as they can deal with. And to my opinion, I mean, that's a good thing. It's a good thing these people can make good pay and support their families.
Such an important work that you're doing. Look, you're an American, I'm an American. What is your hope for America?
Man, I hope we get through this election, that democracy is preserved, and, you know, we could start to move together and, you know, see people prospering again. I'm old enough, I was a kid, but I'm old enough to remember in the 60s. I'm not going to say things were great in the 60s, but I can look back at the 60s and go, things were going in the right direction. And I hope I could say that again going forward.
Dean, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing some important insights about housing in America. It's certainly a big issue. And I think everything that you've talked about has been beneficial for our viewers. And certainly, like you said, politics is always local. So let's hope that some of the local politicians who are watching and some of the local builders say, yeah, we should build more housing and also make a housing situation affordable for renters as well as mortgage owners. Appreciate you, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Coming back with more in just a moment. Welcome to America's Hope. You know, at the heart of everyone's life is the goal to make life matter, to live a purpose-driven life. And we're going to introduce you to someone who's been doing that through a security firm that she has, also through a nonprofit that she has, as well as giving advice to people all over the world through her faith-based approach to helping people understand their better selves. Kenyatta McKinnon, she is an experience worth noting. She is a dedicated and passionate leader, and with a fresh perspective on empowerment, faith, security, and personal growth, Kenyatta is here now joining us to guide a lot of people on a transformative journey. And your journey is a testament, Kenyatta, to the power of resilience, faith, and a commitment to making a difference. Talk to me. First of all, welcome to the show. Welcome to America's Hope. And you're joining us from L.A., lovely Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of love for people who live in Atlanta, Georgia, because of all of the things that they've accomplished. Look, you have risen above many challenges, and in order to pursue not only your business, but also to pursue helping people over two decades now, helping people with law enforcement. Tell me your story.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood where bravery and justice was, you know, the theme for a small community I grew up in. My father served in the military. And so I think that growing up around integrity and around people wanting to protect other people, I think that was kind of like that kind of like jump started me into me wanting to do more to give back to the community. And at one point I had an encounter with a law enforcement officer, and I saw him interact with a young lady who had been burglarized, and I saw the passion that he had with her and how he dealt with her, which really pivoted me to say, I really want to give back to the community. I really want to protect and serve people. And so that's really what started, my law enforcement career. And from there, it was just a series of events that took place. And so I ended up here, because of the process I went through.
So that one action of a caring police officer, and there are many, and we should point that out, that really sparked something in you. And my understanding is you went on to get your degree in criminology and then created your own security firm.
I did. Being that I've been in law enforcement for over 23 years, I've dealt with the community side of it and I've dealt with the law enforcement side of it. And as you know, we have a lot of things that have been going on, in this country, with law enforcement and citizens. So I felt the need to help people understand both sides so that we could bridge the gap. And so I think that it was important for people to know that, we are here to help. We're here to see what we can do so that we can make a better future for everybody, not just law enforcement in the community, but everybody as a whole.
I love what you're talking about. I have a friend who works in law enforcement. He's been doing it for more than 30 plus years and has advised presidents as well as governors about police and how they can actively care for people in the communities they serve. But if you're going to actively care for people as a law enforcement officer, doesn't it have to be reciprocated from people in the community as well?
Absolutely. And I think that it's important that, the officers get a chance to be able to be familiar with the communities that they serve in order to have that relationship established so that, everybody is clear, on expectations. I think a lot of times, as law enforcement officers, I think that, we may enter into, but not actually have relationships with the communities that we serve. So I think it's important for that dynamic to happen in order for individuals to better understand so that we can all, get together and bridge the gap because it's a huge gap. So
Yeah.
that's the purpose.
Yeah, indeed. And Kenyatta, the gap is not just in black communities between law enforcement and African American citizens. It's also unfortunately in a lot of other communities. What do you think has been the disconnect and the deep divisions within communities and police officers? Because there are a lot of police officers who care. They show up every morning and every night with families of their own. And yet they risk their lives to serve their communities.
Absolutely. I wrote a book called Bridging the Gap. And in that book, I don't just talk about African Americans, but I also talk about Hispanics and other nationalities that have been victims of, the system, whether it was law enforcement with community or community with law enforcement. And I think it's important that in order for us to better understand the dynamics of how things work, I think that it's communication. The community needs to understand what the role is of law enforcement, and law enforcement also needs to understand what is the role of the community and how we can work together in order to be able to better assist the needs of the community and make it safe for everybody, not just the community, but officers as well as a whole. And I think that's one of the things that, we need to, do more of, getting to know and having a relationship with the communities, and communicating with them so they understand the needs and the expectations on both sides.
It's so important because the community can help the law enforcement personnel. Through your business, what have you been able to do to highlight that?
I've been able to do conferences to help the youth and kind of instruct them and give them guidance on when they encounter police officers, what should be their response and how they should act, as well as talking to community and forums and groups to help them understand better that law enforcement officers, we only really, I'm retired now, but we only really come to the scene if we're called to go to the scene. So it's not like we're getting up every morning, just trying to find something to do. We're always called to something and then we respond to it. So just getting the community to understand that we're here to help. We're here to assist them. We're here to make sure that, everything moves as smoothly as possible with their kids, with the youth, with the community, and whatever issues that the community is experiencing. You know, we as, you know, law enforcement, we're here to help people, not hurt people. And I think that sometimes the perception of law enforcement is that, you know, we want to just go out and just do, you know, things because we carry a badge and we have, you know, the right to do it. But the community needs to understand that everybody's not like that. There is a few bad apples. But for the most part, the majority of the law enforcement officers that I've encountered and I've experienced, including myself, we want to help, not hurt the people.
Yeah, well said. And I appreciate you for stating that, because it's part of your mission, which, of course, is to empower, uplift, and support individuals across the globe. Talk to me about your mission. You've been able to do a lot just beyond law enforcement. You know, you have your master's degree in public administration. You're also an ordained minister, you know, with 25 years of experience in law enforcement, as you've talked about. And like you said, author of the book, Bridging the Gap. Talk to me about what motivates you to get up in the morning to go out and help somebody.
You know, the biggest thing for me is empowering individuals and other people so that we can create and celebrate not only diversity, but creativity and ideas, and transform lives so that we can grow together and empower positive change. I think a lot of times it's important for us to want to be able to grow and expand our capacity and be able to talk to people, be able to mentor people, be able to coach people, be able to help people understand some of the things that they can do to help them grow, not only spiritually, but emotionally, physically, and also, you know, in their business. And, you know, if they, you know, are on a spiritual journey or a spiritual walk, you know, to just really empower them to be the best individual that they could be.
If we fail to do that, and you know, people talk about people living in various zip codes, and from a political standpoint, you have Republicans and Democrats talking about zip codes that people live in, and that in certain zip codes, bad things happen. In certain zip codes, people fail at life. In certain zip codes, people never get a good education. In certain zip codes, people always have trouble with police, and police have trouble with the people. But there are exceptions. And should we even be defining ourselves according to the zip codes we live in?
I don't think so. I think that just because you are in an environment, you don't have to be a product of that environment. And I'm sure that there are plenty of stories around the country where people may not have had the best upbringing, but they turn out to be really good people and make a positive impact in society. And I think it's important to not count those people out. I think it's important to not differentiate those people or separate those people because of the demographics or where they live or, you know, the communities that they're in. I think that we need to, you know, enlighten our mindset and know that, you know, it's opportunities for everybody. And just because you may have started there, you don't necessarily have to end there.
America, I'm talking to Kenyatta McKinnon, and we're going to take a break and come back with more of Kenyatta's powerful, inspiring story as a member of the law enforcement community, retired now, but still serving America with her skill set of faith, hope, and love. Back with more of America's Hope in just a moment. Welcome back to America's Hope. I'm having the pleasure of talking to Kenyatta McKinnon. And as I stated before, she is a dedicated and passionate leader with a fresh perspective on empowerment, faith, security, and personal growth. Let's talk now, Kenyatta, I mean, for all the great work that you've done as a law enforcement member of the community, and thank you for your service. Let's talk about not just security, but personal growth. Because personal growth is very fundamental to, you mentioned earlier, mentoring. Personal growth is fundamental to our future in America, and that's our children, as well as young adults who are trying to still find their way, and even some older Americans who are having a change in life dynamic because of whatever's happened to their personal economy or the job they were once working, they have it no more. How do you help people grow?
Well, the first thing I think is important is for them to understand where they are and where they can be. I think a lot of times, because they don't have the necessary tools and resources and they don't have access to information that other people may have, they think that they're failures or they think that they may not be able to do what they want to do. I talk to a lot of people and they really aspire and would like to do a lot of things, but they don't know how to go about it. They don't know the resources and the tools that are available to help them get to where they want to go.
What's the greatest reward when you see someone take your advice through your nonprofit organization to reach out and help people, when you see them take off and become successful?
It is a great feeling to know that I was able to change a life, that I was able to empower somebody to be able to succeed and go where they couldn't go before. And so the greatest reward to me is when I have people that come through my coaching and mentorship program and they're successful and they're doing well and they're able to pass the information along to others that they encounter to help them get to where they need to go. So that's to me lets me know that my contribution is not in vain, that I've done something to help somebody and this person was successful and now this person can go back and take the same information and the resources and tools and help somebody else who needs to be helped as well. So that's the greatest reward for me.
So all of that is really a component of your goal to help people be empowered and to see them maintain and sustain their personal growth. There's another element to your life, Kenyatta, and that's faith. Where does faith play a role in your life in empowering you to try to help inspire others?
I feel like without my faith, I wouldn't be where I am now. I've, been through a lot of atrocities through life, but because, I had a strong belief in faith, I was able to persevere and push through those obstacles and be able to be successful in the process. And so once I knew that, if you have faith and you stay the course, that you can thrive, that you can meet things and do things that you probably felt you couldn't do before. And I think that the fact that my faith is so strong, I think that it has cultivated and thrived me and pushed me into where I am now. And I think without that, I wouldn't be where I am now. So faith really plays a big role.
Yeah.
And I'm just grateful that, thankful that, through me being committed and following through, no matter what my circumstances was, my faith got me through and I was able to, move on. And I'm here now where I am, now because of my faith. So
Look,
I think that
you're.
that is that was like very important for me.
Oh, that's very important that you share that. But you're a successful businesswoman. You're an entrepreneur. You're a coach, a life coach. You mentioned earlier in that statement about your faith that you were exposed to certain atrocities and you had to overcome adversity. Share a little bit of that for us about your personal story and your struggle in overcoming that and becoming who you are today.
Absolutely. I went through a phase in my life where I lost my brother in 2008, my mother in 2014, and my father in 2017. So at that time, my whole family within 7 years that I had been born and raised and knew of was completely gone. So I had nobody. It was just me. So, I had to rely on my faith. I had to, really get a sense of where I'm going because at that particular time, I really didn't have worries. I did really didn't have a care in the world because I was just living, just lifing. But when sometimes when we go through things like that, we know that the only thing that carried us through was our faith. And I think because of me going through losing my family, being adopted at a young age, I was adopted at 2 months, and was my adopted family was completely wiped out within 7 years, due to illness or sickness or whatever have you. This was some of the things that I was facing, and it was my faith that kept me focused. It was my faith that got me through. It was my faith that allowed me to keep going, even when I didn't want to keep going. You know, sometimes I just felt like giving up because, you know, I didn't have anybody. It was just me by myself. And I'm like, you know, what am I to do? You know, but my faith got me through, my commitment, my resilience, my dedication to just, you know, just making it no matter what. And I think that for me, that push me to where I am now. I think that if I've never had experienced that, I may not have been in the position I'm in today. So,
Wow.
my faith has really, you know, gotten me where I am.
Wow. Kenyatta, I thank you for sharing that. I'm so glad that you're here to tell us your wonderful story about triumphing over adversity. Based on what you've lived and what you're doing today to help people throughout this country and even throughout the globe, what's your hope for America?
My hope for America is that America can thrive again, that we can cultivate and be able to have creativity and just empower individuals to do all they can do to make America great again, to make America a better place, to be able to build and just help people understand the impact that they have. And no matter how little or big they think it is, it's needed right now in this country for sure.
I like how you say that no matter how little someone thinks their gifting is, continue to give it because it's important. Despise not the humble beginnings. I like that. Kenyatta, thank you for joining
Yes.
us. Kenyatta McKenya.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Talking about the power of resilience, faith, and a commitment to making a difference. You are doing that, my friend. God bless you. Thank you for being on America's
You
Vote.
too. Bless you too. Thank you.
Back with more in just a moment. And welcome back to America's Hope. I'd like to thank our guests who appeared on our program, Kenyatta McKinnon and Dean Baker. Both of these individuals resonating the hope that they have for America, and that is to see all Americans come together and keep lifting up hope to make this nation better, stronger, and more hope-filled. Until next time, America, good night. God bless.